I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Hemp sounds like the perfect plant. It requires less water than corn. It's good for the soil. It can be used for food, fuel, and fiber, and it's lightweight and strong. It was a popular crop in the United States until 1937 when it was banned. It's now staging a comeback with the passage this year of the Farm Bill that allows the cultivation of industrial hemp in a number of states. Our guest Doug Fine says this is good news for the country, for both the economy and the environment, and you don't hear that every day. His book, Hemp Bound, is about the entrepreneurs, the scientists, the activists, the hempsters who see many possibilities in this ancient crop. Doug Fine has worked as a journalist, in fact, was an NPR contributor and reporter, and he lives off the grid in a farm in New Mexico, and he joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. And Doug Fine, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Oh, it's a pleasure to be with you, Marty.
Let's start with some really basic questions, because I think there is some confusion about what hemp is and what it isn't. How is it different from marijuana?
Generally speaking, the industrial cannabis or hemp plant, which is in play everywhere in the U.S. and soon to be in the U.S. again, is defined as having 0.1% of THC or less. That's the psychoactive component of cannabis that, you know, allowed Woodstock to happen.
And does it look like marijuana when it's growing?
Not really. The only similarity is in the shape of the leaves. You know, they're from the same plant family, but they grow very, very differently, and they can't grow in the same place because psychoactive cannabis is only the female plants, and the flowers are the market for recreational or medicinal cannabis, whereas hemp, you're growing everything because you're looking for seed and fiber, and if that pollen from the hemp plant gets into the psychoactive crop, it ruins it. The psychoactive crop is like the prima donna. It's a manicured plant.
So this is more the more drab cousin?
I would say so, although in the long run, I think more valuable, Marty.
Well, why was it banned in 1937? I know there's a lot of history there, but and it's interesting that it was in the Farm Bill, and I do want to talk about that, but why was it banned back in the 30s?
Essentially because of a typo. So in 1937, another, I think, very bad policy was the initial banning of cannabis in general. You know, we've had this terrible 77-year-old failure of a drug war, but industrial cannabis was sort of lumped in there when the Marijuana Tax Act was passed in 1937, and immediately it started shipping jobs offshore. The Navy needed 40 tons of hemp rigging for every vessel, and World War II breaks out, and the Japanese capture our offshore site in the Philippines. So all of a sudden, the U.S. Department of Agriculture sounds like your roommate with the lava lamp making a propaganda film by 1942 begging farmers to grow hemp and really espousing the many uses, the vital uses of the hemp plant for the American war effort.
Was there also concern that because it was hemp and could be used in so many different ways, that some businesses saw it as a threat to their bottom line, to their profit margins?
Well, as a journalist, I have to be meticulous about that. There isn't a smoking gun. I wish I could time travel and be there with Hearst and DuPont and in the wood paneled club with the brandy and the cigar, saying, "Rudolph, I need you to badmouth this plant for my, you know, timber interest or my cotton interest or whatever." It probably happened, but there's no question the yellow journalism against the overall cannabis plan in Hearst newspapers was that happened. We can see in the newspapers, but as for exactly why it happened, it could have just been to sell papers, because sensationalist news stories sell papers, the whole reefer madness era.
But what's so interesting is that it's now legal to cultivate under certain conditions in, I guess, now 13 states in the United States. Part of the Farm Bill, I mean, it seems almost like a stealth thing that happened. How did it end up in the Farm Bill?
Oh, my gosh. It just seems like a miracle. I have to say, I've been in the field around the world researching hemp for 2 years, and then all of a sudden Congress and the president get it together and end this ridiculous counterproductive 77-year ban on hemp. It was absolutely the right thing to do. Hemp bills have come before Congress before, and they sort of get laughed out, and then all of a sudden in this year's Farm Bill it happens. We have a Representative Jared Polis of Colorado really to thank for that. He was the spearheaded that effort to get hemp back in the Farm Bill. I think in the end, the reason is bottom line. The Canadian hemp industry, the modern hemp industry, is 15 years old and is going to broach $1 billion for Canada this year. And American farmers are aching to get in on that.
You also write about this. He's a national hemp and sustainability lobbyist, a guy named Michael Bowman. You credit him also with at least bending some ears or talking to some representatives, even the president about this.
That's right. Yeah, Michael and a few other people. There's a fellow named Ben Droz who's lobbying in Congress now. And then on the state level, they're passionate hemp supporters in places like North Dakota and Colorado, often very politically conservative people that are just trying to find a cash crop for farmers. We're down to 1% of Americans farming now. When hemp was banned in 37, we were 30% farming nation. Mm-hmm. So it really provides an opportunity to get farmers back on the land, I think.
I also noticed that Senator Mitch McConnell of Kentucky, is one of the states that's going to allow some of this cultivation and management, is a big supporter, a big proponent of hemp.
You know, I think lurking behind what we're talking about here, Marty, is boy, isn't it kind of surprising that this broad spectrum of politicians are willing to support this crop? And I'm finally myself getting used to the fact that we don't have to be looking over our shoulder. It seems like everyone, the people and the politicians, recognize that this is an important plant for our economy and for our soil, frankly.
So what does this part of the Farm Bill, what does it allow people, or maybe even universities, what does it allow them to do?
It's really a first step. In states that you mentioned, the 13 states that have hemp legislation, it allows those 13 states to conduct what they call cultivar or hemp variety research in preparation for getting commercial industry going. So it's really a research bill, but that's important. The Canadians did that too, with a lot of government support. Unfortunately, so we haven't talked too much about the history. Many listeners will know that in colonial times, both Thomas Jefferson and George Washington cultivated hemp. Thomas Jefferson's draft of the Declaration of Independence was written on hemp. Virginia colonists could pay their taxes in hemp. It was a very important crop through the 1920s and 30s. So we had developed these cultivars that were the pride of the world. We had the leading market for hemp in the world, the highest quality hemp. Fortunately, I found out in my research of hemp that seed stock died out. It was kind of in a crate in the back of the National Seed Repository in Virginia.
Truly?
Yeah, and it went rotten. Yeah. So we're rebuilding it now. And that's why the Farm Bill provision was important. Because there, you know, people that know how valuable hemp is are saying, come on, let's plant it. Let's plant with Darwin's varieties, which are those that survived in our ditches in Nebraska. Mm-hmm. Others are saying, no, we got to build a grown-up, real-world agricultural industry, and that involves researching the cultivars that will work in American climates. And, you know, I see the wisdom of that more mature approach.
Well, and it's also the infrastructure as well, sort of rebuilding, I guess, the infrastructure for hemp as well.
That's where I'm particularly interested, because as much as I kind of, as a rural New Mexican, I kind of wave the flag of the rancher and the farmer and putting farmers back to work and small farm, all that good, you know, stuff that Willie Nelson loves with his Farm Aid. In truth, we're talking about a massive industry. Psychoactive cannabis today is among our nation's biggest cash crops, if not the biggest. I think industrial cannabis or hemp is going to be even bigger. And my shorthand for that is Coors is big, but right. ExxonMobil is bigger. So what I really have been preaching as I talk about hemp is the upside of prohibition. First generation American farmers building those processing factories can process for many applications in the plant. The profitable seed oil, the many industrial fiber applications, and what I really want to see is a carbon-friendly energy from the waste biomass. Once North Dakota, forget amber waves of grain. Once we have amber waves of hemp growing in the heartland, that's going to, I think, help wean us from fossil fuels.
But do you see this as something that small family-type farms would be growing, or something that would be grown on a more industrial scale?
I think both. I conducted an interview with kind of the hemp seed oil mogul of Canada, Sean Crew, and he was undergoing his facility, Chile, Manitoba, you know, prairies up there in Canada, his fourth expansion in 10 years. He can't keep up. He can't wait for us to get our hemp back in the soil in the U.S. because there's not enough, you know, growth. There's not enough farmers planting in their hugely growing market in Canada. So I started a question. As a small rancher myself, I said, you know, I got 40 acres. What if I were to plant 20 or 30? And he just sort of said, talk to the hand. No. Hold on. That is not – if you're not growing 1,000 acres, you're just a hobby farmer. So I did the math. Canadian farmers today are making $300 per acre profit. You know, this is over expenses. And if he's saying none of these guys and ladies in Manitoba and Alberta are growing less than 1,000 acres, 1,000 times 300 per acre, that's real money. That's a third of $1 million profit for a small farmer per year. So that's fantastic. But I also know from the amount of oil, seed oil that hemp provides, that if I were to grow 2 or 3 acres of it on my own ranch, I would be able to feed my family the omega-rich and today very expensive oil that we use in our morning shake, and feed my goats and chickens with the seed cake that remains after the pressing. So you can actually do individual and community-based levels on less than that 1,000 acres, for sure.
You know, I have to say, talking to you and also reading your book and doing some research on hemp, it almost feels too good to be true. How can there be a plant or a crop that does all these good things? It doesn't seem to have a downside. Is there a downside to industrial hemp?
Marty, the downside for me is not sounding like your roommate with the lava lamp
exactly.
as I'm conducting these real discussions with journalists like you. You know, it's like, it's real. I've seen it in the field. I'll give you one example. In the Netherlands, I visited the hemp fiber factory that today provides fiber to BMW and Mercedes for use in their door panels. Why is Mercedes doing that? They're not wearing tie-dyes over there, I promise you. They're doing it because it's your roommate was right. Hemp's fibers are stronger than steel. They're easily replicable. So it grows like a weed. They require a lot less energy for production than petroleum-based plastics once you start making biocomposites and stuff out. And this maps over to the construction industry as well. Natural fibers like hemp work. They perform better in the real world. So, gosh, what is the downside? The fact that there's huge profits to be made today doesn't guarantee that there's huge profits to be made tomorrow. What if the bottom drops out of the market? That could happen, I guess.
Sure.
But I don't think it's going to happen because the demand curve is in a Malthusian kind of growth.
You even describe in your book seeing, I guess it's a tractor made of hemp, and you punch it, I mean, with all your force, and it does not dent.
Stronger and lighter than petroplastic. Yeah, so it's not only can you give it the kick test, but it winds up being more fuel efficient because the fiber of the same strength weighs a lot less than petroleum plastic, and all the niceness that we're doing to the earth for not using petroleum.
And does this hemp built tractor, does it look like a tractor you'd see almost anywhere? Is it something unusual?
It does. No, it looks totally like a tractor. It was really funny seeing these Canadian government funded researchers up there, and I've got a video of this on my website. Sort of suggesting names to them. I have an online handle of Organic Cowboy, so I offered that as the model name. Call it the Organic Cowboy, and we joked like we should call it the Hemp Reaper or whatever.
Right.
Made from local Canadian fiber that's going to then harvest the crop that it's made out of. It's fantastic, and it just looks like, a John Deere tractor.
That's Doug Fine, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. I guess I can call you a hempster, yes?
I think so.
Okay. He's also the author of a new book. It's called Hemp Bound, and it's subtitled Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. And earlier this year, the Farm Bill allows the cultivation. The Farm Bill that was passed by Congress and signed by the president allows the cultivation of industrial hemp in now 13 states. We're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. We're talking about hemp in this hour of Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Touchstone Center for Crafts supports WHYY, a residential craft school located in Farmington, Pennsylvania. 4.5 hours from Philadelphia in the Laurel Highlands. Offering weekend and week-long workshops in a variety of traditional and emerging craft forms, including blacksmithing, ceramics, and jewelry arts on its 150-acre woodland campus. Touchstone Center for Crafts, the natural setting for your creative nature. Information at 1-800-721-0177.
Support for WHYY comes from Delaware Valley College. Delaware Valley College offers a Master of Arts in Counseling Psychology that prepares culturally competent practitioners to work in the mental health field. Students can choose from social justice community counseling or child and adolescent counseling. More information about a Master's of Arts in Counseling Psychology from Delaware Valley College is available online at delval.edu/grad.
HMS School for Children with Cerebral Palsy supports WHYY. HMS School, located in University City in Philadelphia, serves school-aged children and young adults through age 21 who have complex, multiple disabilities, usually resulting from cerebral palsy, traumatic brain injury, or other neurological impairment. An open house will be on Thursday, April 24th and Saturday, April 26th from 9 to 11 a.m. Details at hmsschool.org or 215-222-2566.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen talking with Doug Fine about hemp. And for about 75 years, it was banned. It's now legal to grow or cultivate hemp for industrial uses in 13 states, part of the Farm Bill that was passed earlier this year, something I was not aware of. Doug Fine is a hemp enthusiast, as you can hear, also has written a book called Hemp Bound, and we have an explosion of phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. You did interview a farmer, and he said that, talking about growing hemp, quoting here, the most difficult crop he'd ever worked with. Help us understand what some of the challenges are, I guess, of growing hemp.
Yeah, that was Grant Dickin, a Canadian heartland, very religious Christian family in Canada. And he, you know, I think he said it was, you know, comparable with the heart. And it was all about the learning curve. The harvesting equipment, for instance. We used to in North America have hemp harvesting equipment, but he's had to jerry-rig it so that he caused a few fires in his harvester from friction as he was trying to harvest the fiber. And when I visited experienced European farmers and processors, they're still jerry-rigging their harvesters for each new application that comes online, because hemp's markets are always growing. And so as I was leaving the factory of this one well-established European hemp company called Hempflax, I saw sparks flying and workers banging on tractors, and I asked what was going on, and they said, this year we're not just harvesting seed and fiber, but there's a market now for the flowers in body care and healthcare. It makes a nice moisturizer.
Wow.
And so we have to raise our harvester to a whole nother level for this third kind of harvest. So, you know, there's a learning curve associated with it. Another issue is post-harvest. You look at 10th century sketches from France of people, you know, serfs harvesting. Still today, after you harvest and get the seed out, which is the real profits are today, if you want to do something with the fiber, you have to rotate it in the field for several weeks, a process called redding. It's a fungal battle that eats away at the hard bark of the hemp so that you can get at the valuable fiber within, and it can't get too wet, it can't get too dry, and basically we have to move the technology into the 21st century. There is a way to do this called decortication. It's a machine that's very expensive. So there is a learning curve,
sure,
for farmers, but it's not insurmountable for experienced farmers.
You also write that it's not only a good crop that way, it's also good for the soil.
Oh, yeah.
How does that work?
Phytoremediation is the official soil healing term. Hemp has some remarkable qualities. So first of all, it leaches toxics from soil. It was used, for instance, to clean up radioactive soil after the Chernobyl nuclear disaster. It's an annual plant that grows very, very fast and has foot-long tap roots, which is important for soil stabilization. A Nebraska rancher told me that her father used to plant it along their irrigation ditches because it was so effective at preventing floods.
Oh.
And then they'd put the cattle on it after watering season, and the cattle loved the high protein, enjoyed eating the hemp, and it was really good for them. So map that onto places like sub-Saharan Africa that have severe drought. I visited Colorado's first commercial hemp farmer, Ryan Laughlin, last year, and he found that big commercial, federally subsidized farming in a conservative part of eastern Colorado, very near Kansas, and he found that his debut hemp crop was requiring half the water that the previous year's wheat crop had, and he found that very valuable for his neighbors in that Oglala Reservoir that's drying up from overuse and with drought and climate change. His neighbors are going to be able to make a profit while restoring their soil, dry land cropping, since they don't have the water to use from their reservoir anymore. So it's extremely important that hemp is water friendly.
It's interesting because you've described a number of the people that you talk to as being either conservative or Christians, or what was the sort of diversity of the people that you met as you were doing your research for your book?
Farmers or business people? That was one of my big lessons, right? And so any farmer at this point knows, and this is, I'm talking about any big corn, wheat, and soy farmer in the U.S. today, knows what's happening with Canadian profits. Farmers know what crops are making money. That's what they do. It's like dentists know how to fix teeth, right? So there's no politics involved in it anymore. I went to very conservative places, interviewed people in North Dakota and, as I said, in eastern Colorado, and there's no stigma associated with hemp anymore. There's all these sort of upsides of our long prohibition, too. We have the facilities to process, for instance, hemp textiles, and I'm, of course, wearing my hemp shirt here in the studio today.
I was going to say, I should have said that at the very beginning. No, go ahead, Doug.
And so in Canada, they're doing research on how to increase what they call the hand, which is the clothing industry term for softness. So if you go to a mall chain shop and you find a certain cotton shirt that's super soft, that has very good hand, and hemp's hand is improving. The Chinese are kind of at the forefront of this. China's president visits their hemp factories. So in Canada, they came up with this fantastic weave that they think would be great for textile applications, and they had to ship it to a Pennsylvania fiber processing factory because they didn't have the facilities up there. Huh. And I mention this because new industries are always risky, and the hemp industry is new. Most new industries fail, but we can be a little bit more bullish about hemp beyond the $300 per acre that farmers will make from season one here in the U.S. Colorado farmers will be making those profits today, but also because we have things like the farm-to-rail network in Ohio where people can get the fiber and the seed oil to factories in Cleveland very easily. We have textiles factories waiting to be reopened in South Carolina. It's just another thing that we have here in the States that I think is going to help launch hemp in a very big way.
I do want to get to our callers, but one thing is you caution, I guess, or perhaps you have some concerns that if cannabis or hemp becomes sort of taken over by the big name industries, it might lose some of the more, what, underground counterculture mythology of it.
Right. Hemp's brand is beyond don't be evil. It's be actively good. It's best encapsulated. You know, I have no connection to this company other than I'm a longtime customer. Dr. Bronner's Magic Soaps, right. Third generation company that has hemp. CEO David Bronner, grandson of the founder, Harvard educated guy. He makes five times more than his lowest paid employee. Everything's fairly traded. The olive oil and the soap comes from a grove jointly managed by Israelis and Palestinians. It's a righteous brand. And that there have been studies about this specifically with regard to hemp, I think out of Purdue, that hemp has another thing going for it, really, really enthusiastic consumer support. People that are buying it thinking that they're doing a good thing, and they frankly are. So that brand, doing things right, is actually part of the bottom line profit value for the new industry. So why is that important? It's important because the Canadians get this. When they started their new industry in 1998, they're 15 years in now, they prophylactically banned genetically modified hemp. It doesn't exist, but it's banned in Canada. And the reason for that is Frankenhemp is not part of the brand. I have no problem with the McHemp sandwich as long as it's not genetically modified. So if we see, instead of amber waves of GMO grain in the heartland, if we see green flowering hemp plants, that's fine with me. I don't care if it's big business or small business, as long as it's not genetically modified.
And that's Doug Fine, our guest in this hour of Radio Times. We're talking about hemp. It's making a comeback. He's also written a book called Hemp Bound: Dispatches from the Frontlines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. He's written a number of books. He's also worked as a journalist. In fact, was a reporter for NPR for some time. We have just a couple open lines at 1-888-477-9499. Let me get Andy from Wilmington, Delaware, to join us. Hi, Andy. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hello.
Hi there.
I'm wondering about the sustainability of growing hemp. Because it grows so fast, it uses tons of nitrogen, just like corn does. And corn, as we grow it today, is not a sustainable product. So I'm wondering, besides the benefits of the deep roots and so on and so forth, is hemp truly sustainable, and how much nitrogen does it use to grow such a fast-growing crop?
Andy, thanks for the call to Radio Times, Doug.
That was a great question, Andy. So there's a couple ways I want to approach the answer to that. But first of all, if you go to the Canadian government's farmers' sites, Canadian Agriculture Department sites, and look up the official government recommendations for hemp, it tells all kinds of things that you do in terms of soil building. And when it gets to pesticides and herbicides, it just says none needed. So, first of all, that's a big deal. That's a very big deal. That's why we don't need genetically modified hemp. It grows like a weed. Now, ideally, soil health is a very important thing, and I'm a sustainability journalist. It's something that I care a lot about. Any crop that is grown as a monoculture crop over time can have soil depleting qualities. Hemp is actually not very demanding of any of the basic agricultural nutrients, but if you're a professional trying to do a good job, you want to have healthy soil.
Sure.
And that's why when I plant my own crop after legalization in my state in New Mexico, I was on the Hill lobbying my own senators the other day. I plan to do a healthy checkerboard rotation with food, vegetable crops, cereals, alfalfa for my goats, and hemp, and keep my soil in a healthy balance. That's the, you know, the way to grow. That's the way to manage land in general. But overall, hemp is a very easy, soil-friendly, in fact, soil-restorative crop to grow.
Andy, thanks for the call. We have an email from Chris. What about making flour out of the stalk of the hemp plant? I've heard that it's actually more nutritious than wheat flour.
We have at my ranch, in our fridge, actually, hemp seed flour, and it makes fantastic, delicious pancakes. I cannot speak enough about hemp's nutritive qualities. By philosophy, I'm a fellow who believes you pay the grocer today to avoid the doctor tomorrow, and so that's why I spend the big bucks on this expensive Canadian organic hemp oil that I put in our morning shakes. But don't take my word for it. I went and researched this study that's underway at University of Manitoba where laying hens, chickens, control groups fed normal kind of corn-based feed. This other group was fed a hemp-based diet. The omega profile in the hemp-fed chickens in turn is passed on to the eggs that we eat. I also have a video of this one on my site, because if you look at the site, at the eggs rather, they just look so much better. Yeah, robust orange, yeah.
You also talk about someone who makes a product, I guess it's a healthy or an energy bar called Gorp.
Yes, the Grant Dick, the farmer that we talked about earlier, who said hemp was hard to grow, he was really complaining about his wife. His awesome, they're just a great family there in the heartland of Manitoba. His wife Colleen is a triathlete. She was not satisfied with the energy bars that were out there, and she knew about hemp's nutritive profile, so she made a prototype, won a food competition in Canada, got funded, and now has this company that makes these, I can tell you, fantastic hemp bars that her husband grows the hemp for. And I should say, on a side note, they gave me, when I visited their farm, 800 pounds of this stuff to bring back to the U.S. And when I crossed back at the border and was asked if I had any, drugs by the Border Patrol people, I said, I've got about, a lot of hemp with me in these energy bars, but that didn't seem to worry the customs guys.
Oh, didn't? Oh, well, that's interesting, though. Is that a change, do you think?
No, it's always been cool to bring in hemp products, but I should say that was the result of a lawsuit by American producers sued the DEA successfully in the 90s, kind of an interesting moment in hemp history, to be allowed to import finished hemp products. Now, of course, we fought the Declaration of Independence, the War of Independence to be allowed to have our own industries here in the States, and that's what's going on with hemp. We can now import the food, but for a few more years, we can't cultivate it here in the U.S., which is, of course, absurd.
But that's changing, obviously, with the Farm Bill.
Right.
Let me see what Dennis from Hopewell has to say. Hi, Dennis. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Thanks
for taking my call.
Sure.
That question is about industrialization of hemp products. Another nice organic thing is wood pulp, which it turns out in the process of turning wood pulp into paper produces a tremendous amount of waste product that is, not necessarily very nice to the environment. And how does hemp try to avoid such a problem in the future?
Dennis, thanks for the call. Doug, go ahead.
I think that that's a good entree to speak about hemp as a construction material. There is a general hemp building mode that's known as hempcrete, and it's basically mixing hemp fiber. And this is a great market for early hemp farmers in the U.S. because it doesn't require a lot of skill in processing the fiber. Once you get your seed and make your big money from that, chop up the fiber, mix it with lime, and it makes this carbon negative. It's a carbon-eating insulation material that's very easy to work with. And when I interviewed, so this is a building revolution going on all over Europe, and I interviewed some of the big builders in Britain and Europe about this. They're building Marks and Spencer department stores out of hemp and everything like that. And I asked them, is it a no-brainer for building with hemp? versus other materials, and they're getting better R value, better insulation value from this hemp material than, let's say, fiberglass insulation on the insulation side. But the really big deal is when you're dealing with traditional concrete, you're heating up to something like 3,000 degrees. You're generating a huge amount of energy just on site. I think construction is something like 10% of greenhouse emissions, of carbon emissions. So it's a big deal to not have to just generate a lot of energy just on the building site. But then you're also building these carbon neutral homes, carbon negative homes that are really actually performing well in the real world, both in insulation, load bearing, even soundproof type walls. Construction is just one example where hemp has lower energy production costs going into the application, and then actually performing way better in the real world. So in general, you could shorthand it as saying natural fibers are better to use than petroleum-based fibers, but specifically with hemp, it's in the real world marketplace because it's winning. It outperforms our sort of petroleum-based economy.
And do you see hemp replacing wood pulp for paper? I mean, do you see, if assuming things continue as they look like they are?
This is where the folks from my publisher eagerly listening today are hoping I'm diplomatic. We initially, when we started negotiating this book, they said we were going to print it on hemp paper, and it turned out that the pulp, it's not there yet in the real world for mass market books. And we all want this. We want tree-free paper. So Chelsea Green, the publisher, is now sponsoring a Colorado farmer to start developing the cultivars that they can use to make books out of hemp. And that'd be a really big dream for me. Hemp clothes, hemp books, we're on our way.
Oh, you talked about this hempcrete, and there's a couple of houses that you write about, I guess, in Asheville.
Yeah.
They are made out of hempcrete, or they use those materials.
Yeah, North Carolina. And I actually visited a site in Canada that was construction was underway. So that you really – it's all fun to talk to architects and theorists and business owners. But I went and talked to the guys and women in the hard hats and their vests.
Well, actually, I have to
and
work
said,
with this
how, stuff, right? How does this stuff work? And they said, oh, my gosh, it's light and airy to work with. You put it in a cement-type mixer, just the hemp and lime, and you could tap it in with your hands or a tamper. You can just paint right over it. There's no need for potentially toxic press board and drywall. There's been a lot of issues with imported drywall and toxic emissions from that stuff. The only learning curve, they said, it took them a couple of days on that particular site in Canada to kind of learn what that mixture is, how much hemp, how much lime. But once they did that, they said it's an absolute pleasure to work with.
And we're talking about insulation here, right? And just sort of just the material of walls.
Right. Yeah. So it's an insulating material that also in the right mixture can be load bearing as well.
Well, let's take another short break. We'll get back to our conversation and our callers talking with Doug Fine about hemp. And he is the author of a new book. It's called Hemp Bound: Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. He has worked as a reporter and also a contributor to NPR. He's written a number of books, including Farewell, My Subaru, Not Really an Alaskan Mountain Man, and Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. We're going to take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Give us a call. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet @WHYY Radio Times. Much more hemp after this very short break. We'll be right back.
Get Healthy Philly, an initiative of the Philadelphia Health Department, supports WHYY. Cigarette butts are one of the most polluted items in the world. Help keep your parks, recreation centers, and playgrounds smoke-free and butt-free. Details at 1-800-QUIT-NOW or smokefreephilly.org.
Support for WHYY comes from Beck Institute, internationally recognized source for cognitive behavior therapy, welcoming clients to their Center for Psychotherapy in Bella Cynwyd. Established by Dr. Judith Beck and Dr. Aaron Beck, founder of cognitive behavior therapy, Beck Institute provides effective treatment for challenges including depression, anxiety, stress, and relationship problems. Details at beckinstitute.org or 610-664-3020.
The Kimmel Center supports WHYY and presents 8 Stops, April 24th through the 27th in SEI Innovation Studio. This new one-woman show was created by Obie Award-winning playwright Deb Margolin as part of the Kimmel Center's theater residency program. 8 Stops explores death, private lives of animals, the suburbs, spiritual exurbs, illness, and desire, all the while raising classic questions about the limits and limitlessness of human compassion. Tickets at KimmelCenter.org.
Supporting WHYY, the Lincoln Motor Company, featuring a panoramic retractable roof on the 2014 Lincoln MKZ that opens up to over 15 square feet of skylight. More at Lincoln.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowen. We are talking about hemp. It requires less water than other crops. It's good for the soil. It can be used for food, for fuel, for fiber. It's lightweight, it's strong, and it's staging a comeback as a result of the Farm Bill that was passed earlier this year that allows the cultivation of industrial hemp in a number of states. That would be 13 states, although not here in Pennsylvania. Talking with Doug Fine, author of a new book called Hemp Bound, and it's about some of the entrepreneurs, the scientists, the hempsters that he has interviewed and spent time with to help him and us understand the possibilities of this ancient crop. Let me get to, looks like Bonnie from Elkins Park to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Bonnie. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Yeah, so my hobby is new and interesting green stocks. I would like to know if there is a company presently listed either in the U.S. or Canada that you know of that lists, or one that's coming up in the future that might be an interesting company to follow. And if there is, could you spell the name of it?
Okay, Bonnie, thanks for the call. Do you know?
Here on Hemp Investment Advice
this
morning.
Exactly.
I promise to give a concrete answer to that in sort of, you know, investor Wall Street terms, but I want to say that what I really am excited to see, and I think that I say this sort of as a patriot, is communities growing, let's say, a coalition of several counties in Pennsylvania, growing hemp for various applications. Different cultivars will be used for seed oil, fiber, et cetera, and having a central community-owned processing facility where what I want to see investors doing is invest in the facilities so that we can process things like the very profitable hemp seed oil. I need it for my morning shake. I want it to be domestic, guys. Please start growing it. All these fiber apps we've been talking about, from construction to paper to clothing to nanotechnology and body armor, for that matter, as well as plane and car door panels. And then that third app of biomass gasification, so that regional communities can wean from fossil fuels and provide their own local energy and almost say goodbye to their grid. They can become the grid. If this sounds too good to be true, look up Feldheim, Germany. They've done it there. They were one of the highest unemployments in Germany, in Bavaria, 30% unemployment, and built these kind of gasification factories for their farm biomass. Not necessarily a lot of hemp, but it doesn't matter. You can put anything in there, and there's these very carbon-friendly way of combusting farm waste to provide truly local energy at not that high a cost. So I want to see those three applications in every American hemp community, and that's where I'd love to see investors go. That said, to answer your question, Bonnie, about companies that are in it today, none of these are endorsements in any kind of way, but I can tell you who some of the major players are, and at the moment I think all of these are privately held companies. But I know I buy a lot of my very expensive organic Canadian grown U.S. company hemp seed oil from Nutiva, N-U-T-I-V-A, Nutiva. I'm a big fan of Dr. Bronner soaps. These are privately held companies. They're doing capitalism right, fantastic people. And then if you look north of the border, there's Manitoba Hemp Harvest is a cooperative. People that kind of doing hemp seed oil only up there, but doing the model that I described where farmers all kind of work together with a processor. And they're a semi-competitor up there in Canada, Hemp Oil Canada, in a more traditional capitalistic way. Those guys might go public at some point. So there's a wide array. There's a number of people who have told me they believe that the first big killer fiber app in the U.S. market is going to be in construction. So if you want to be the person that is mixing that hemp and lime together and getting it in Lowe's and Home Depot, that sounds like a business I'd want to invest in.
Bonnie, thanks for the call. Let me see what Wade from Northeast Philadelphia has to say. Hi, Wade. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
How you doing?
Good. How are you?
Thank you for having this guest. It's a great topic, and all I can say, it's about time, you know. I manufacture cat furniture, cat trees in Philadelphia, and I use a material for the cats to scratch on. It's just generically called sisal, and it's plant fibrous material. They make rope out of it, but they also make a matted material that interior decorators use for wall coverings and area rugs. My question is to your guest is, do you have any sense of one versus the other? I mean, for my purposes, you want it to be durable. So the cat scratching on it, it's, you know, they're not going to rip through it in a short period of time. You want it to last for years. So just wanted to ask if your guest has any sense of, in terms of fiber strength, one versus the other.
Wade, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Dad.
One reason I love that call and that question is because it's an example of, we haven't even begun to scratch the surface of potential hemp applications. You know, here you have a specialty niche of something that you work with where hemp looks like, it sounds like yet again, 1938, this is after hemp was banned federally, Popular Mechanics ran this sort of legendary article called The Billion-Dollar Crop Hemp with 10,000 industrial applications. So now it's 10,001.
For the cats.
For the cats. And I think it maps well, actually, to some of the – if you do a look at the Composites Innovation Center, Google that, you'll find that they're doing – a lot of matting and bedding for all different kinds of applications, including animal applications there, as well as much higher tech applications. But you might find that they've got something going that might work in your application. And my guess is you're going to find hemp to be stronger. And it also, by the way, today is used as animal bedding around Europe in the same chopped up fiber that you could use in construction also makes a nice animal bedding.
Oh, Wade, thanks for the call to Radio Times. We have Sarah, and she's calling us from Chad's Ford, Pennsylvania. Sarah, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Hi there. I know it's not yet legal to grow here in Pennsylvania, but looking to the future, hemp sounds like an ideal crop since it has so few pest problems. But I'm wondering, is it deer resistant?
That's a very Pennsylvania question that you're asking there, Sarah.
Yes, absolutely.
We know all about deer in this state. Yeah, go ahead.
Thank you, Sarah, for finally giving us something that can temper our enthusiasm a little bit. Yeah, I bet you that will be an issue because, as I said, ranchers told me that the cattle love eating hemp traditionally in the heartland. So, there's no question. And I should say, when I was researching for a previous book, Psychoactive Cannabis in Northern California, it was a problem for farmers up there. The deer like to eat the cannabis. Yeah. So that could really be an issue. And as far as how to make it happen in Pennsylvania, on the state level, you guys probably know better than I how to influence people. But I can tell you from being on Capitol Hill the last few days, pounding the hallways for hemp, what I was hearing over and over was, I guess it shouldn't be so shocking in a democracy, was if people hear from their constituents, legislators hear from their constituents, that's where change happens. So if you believe, as I do, as a father, that this is a top-tier issue, let your representatives on the state and federal level know.
And we should say there are 13 states where you can do the kinds of things that we've been talking about: California, Colorado, Kentucky, Maine, Montana, North Dakota, Oregon, Vermont, Washington, West Virginia, and three new ones, Indiana, Tennessee, and Nebraska.
Not liberal places.
No, which is very interesting.
Yeah.
It's just very interesting. Tell us or help us understand or describe for us where you live. You live 40 miles out in the sort of hinterlands of New Mexico, rather near the Mexico border.
Yes, southern New Mexico. It's called the Funky Butte Ranch, and for me, it's all about the quiet. I've lived in Philadelphia before. I grew up on Long Island. I'm so excited to be here with the fantastic restaurants. I miss Asian food and all that good stuff, but I'm out there milking goats in the morning and listening to cactus wrens sing whole note courtship songs and stereo on either side of myself, and therein lies my sanity. It's kind of a little house on the prairie scene. I've got there with my girlfriend and kids, and we, you know, make yogurt every day from the goat milk, and we homeschool our kids and live mostly on solar power, drive on vegetable oil. So it's a different, I don't know, yeah. It's kind of a traditional lifestyle, but I really love it.
Well, and you do have your laptop, right?
Yes.
We can't live without our laptops or our cell phones, I guess.
You can have the best of all worlds these days, you know? I really believe that. And in terms of, you know, feeling as though my kids are getting a good education, breathing clean air, and the quiet, really. It's the quiet that delineates for me rural life versus urban life. It's just, for me, there's this lower general stress level. This morning in the Amtrak station, it was just a nonstop repeated, if you see something, say something, like just constantly. And it's like, come on, this isn't, you know, Orwell was not a supposed to be a demonstration model. It was supposed to be a scare story.
Your previous book to this was is titled Too High to Fail, Cannabis and the New Green Economic Revolution. Do you see a connection, though, between hemp, which we've been talking about, and the fact that marijuana is legal in some states for recreational use, many more states for medicinal use?
I think that they're both going to be valuable for the tax base, and I think from a public safety perspective, without question, America is going to be safer when cannabis prohibition overall ends. Industrially, they're two very different things, and that's why I like to give that Coors versus Exxon analogy. Social / medicinal cannabis is a huge contributor to the economy already. We're seeing numbers coming in out of Colorado. They're higher than expected, and it's already hurting criminal cartels south of the border. Which is something that I care about, living near the border.
Yeah, close to the border, yeah.
So it's win-win. It's win for public safety and win for the economy. It's somewhat coincidental that they're coming back into the economy at the same time because they do such different things. But, again, as a father, I support both the psychoactive cannabis and the hemp economy.
We did an interview a year or so ago about some of the marijuana being grown in a certain part of California, and some of the concerns about just the really bad use of pesticides and despoiling the environment. Does that concern you?
It does. I researched Too High to Fail in Northern California, and what I came away with was the realization that the cannabis industry, as it comes above ground, can launch as the best possible industry or the worst possible industry. In truth, almost all of the downsides associated with the cannabis plant have to do with prohibition itself. If somebody is not able to grow and be registered commercial farmer like every other kind of farmer, and they have to steal water, they're going to be a water thief, and they're going to do it because of the profits. They're into up there in Northern California, third generation farmers up there. Michael Pollan calls them best farmers of his generation, and a lot of them have sustainable ideals and grow organically, and that's the model I think should be supported. So we have to watch very carefully as we end the war on cannabis, as we should. I think of it as America's worst policy since segregation. But we also have to make sure that it comes above ground in a way that's in sync with, I mean, I'm speaking personally, my own sustainability values.
We have, speaking of water, we have a Facebook comment from Doreen. As a farmer, I'm really interested in the water requirements for hemp. We touched on that earlier, but it sounds like, certainly from some of the farmers you talked to, less than wheat, less than corn.
Yeah, Ryan Laughlin is an American hero. He was planting last year in Colorado prior to Colorado implementing its regulations. The voters had already, in the same Amendment 64 that legalized psychoactive cannabis, hemp was specifically mentioned in Colorado as well. And so it was technically legal, but the guidelines hadn't been set by the state yet. And Ryan said, I'm planting anyway because we need to rebuild that seed stock. And he put his whole family's giant subsidized ranch at risk, and his conservative father said, you should do it because of the money involved. We should do this. And he could have been raided at any time. He's rebuilding the seed stock, but his other really valuable contribution was he now has documented in the field that it takes half the water of wheat, which is going to be very valuable to his drought-stricken neighbors.
What do you see as the next step, I guess, for hemp production?
More and more states are, well, first of all, federal law needs to catch up with Colorado law. The Colorado State Agriculture Department, I was there on the first day they started accepting permits from their for commercial, unlimited commercial hemp cultivation. That's a little bit further than federal law allows now. So what we have to do, I think, is support a pending bill that Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon has put forward called S-359, and that allows federal law to catch up with Colorado and let North Dakota farmers, Pennsylvania farmers, any farmers in the U.S. It removes low THC cannabis from the Controlled Substances Act. It's not a drug anymore, of course, and let farmers grow it unlimited. And then we're going to see immediately the industry take off. How do I know? Because of the money that today, if you grow 200 acres, let's say, of hemp seed oil of certain cultivars that the Canadian processors want, they will buy it. They need every bit they can get. Demand is increasing that much. I want to see us generate local processing, but my point is farmers are going to do it right from season one because there's money in it.
We have a Facebook post from Jim. Has the cotton industry fought to keep hemp growing out of the United States?
Oh, I'm so glad to get that question because I keep forgetting to mention that industrial cotton, non-organic cotton, uses 30% of the world's pesticides. And this is the number one reason why China is embracing hemp so much. They're not wearing tie-dyes over there in the Communist Party. It's because they see that's where the future of textiles is. They're getting diminished returns and super poisoned aquifers from their massive cotton industry. So their goal is to plant, I think it was 3 million acres of hemp by 2020. They're really going for it in China. So I don't know that there's organized opposition from the cotton industry. I'm a real big believer that we can change policy and affect policy with our pocketbooks, what we as consumers decide to do. And so the fact that I can wear clothes that demand almost no pesticides at all, there's no point in putting – they're not needed for the most part, pesticides on the hemp crop. And those clothes are going to be better for us.
Well, Doug Fine, thank you very much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Oh, it went so fast I could talk about hemp forever. Thanks for having me.
I know you could. I got that feeling. And again, Doug Fine, our guest. The book is called Hemp Bound, Dispatches from the Front Lines of the Next Agricultural Revolution. And he's speaking tomorrow at noon at the Free Library of Philadelphia. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about this program, including things like Twitter and Facebook and podcasts and email archives and satellite radio. I'm Marty Moscowane. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.